It sounds normal-ish.
Normal-ish is what we shoot for here on this show.
Is it good enough? Yes.
Wait, isn't that the exact opposite of our show? Don't we not let pretty good be the enemy of perfect?
Shush!
Welcome to the Maximize This podcast, the only podcast that promises to accept the results of the election, so long as we win.
In this episode, we talk about whether elections are actually rigged, as Trump likes to complain, and Dear Diary by Todd.
No, it's not a diary.
But first, a quick interlude about Lithuania. The craziest thing about being here, Todd, is think about how much the world has changed in the U.S. since the millennial age came about, right?
Okay.
Like, huge changes, big shift. Now, Lithuania is kind of pretty much caught up now to this Western millennial age. But when I was here 8 years ago and 12 years ago, it felt like a former Soviet republic. So not only did it go through this huge shift from Eastern to Western, it also got the millennial age at the same time. So everything is completely different than it was before. It's incredible.
So there have been major shifts in the way things look and the way society runs since they've had the double whammy of emerging from Eastern Bloc status as well as, you know, the dawning of the internet age.
Exactly. I mean, people are smiling more and they're always on their smartphones. It's just like the U.S.
So it sounds just like everywhere else.
Yeah, exactly. Which is great. Really highly recommended place to visit now.
Yeah, I saw that. I mean, I think when I was flipping around, looking at some of the places that you were going, like the geographic center of Europe and the island castle and some other places, that I stumbled upon the Lithuanian Tourism Board. And it certainly has a lot of attractions that if I ever found myself in the Baltics, I would want to go visit. So we've had a lot of discussions in this campaign season about whether elections are rigged. And I would argue that they are, but not in the way that any of the candidates are really talking about.
I'm going to start by asking you to define rigged.
When I say rigged, I mean the outcome is essentially known in advance, or at least the range of possible outcomes is known well in advance, without choice by the people.
Yeah. I really think we should start by saying, what are people saying about that first? It could mean that there's a system in place that creates this opportunity to vote. There are mechanics of you actually go to the polls and you vote. When you vote, you have an opinion that you vote according to. And when you vote, you have options to choose from. So there is potential for rigging at any of those pieces. One is when you're actually going to vote, are those votes correctly being registered or is there fraud? Two is your opinion when you're going in to vote a fair representation of what you actually think or want? And they're saying there's media bias, so that's rigged because it'll affect the opinions of people in a quote-unquote unfair way. And then the third is more like, within this realm of us going and voting and making decisions, are our decisions actually having any impact in the bigger system? The system is actually set up in a way that no matter what, even if there is no voter fraud, even if there is no media bias, there's still not an ability for our opinions to impact the outcome to get what we actually want as a society.
Right. There's a structural rigging.
I just wanted to very quickly touch on the first two, and then we can dive into the third one, which just sounds like it's maybe the bigger, more important one to our democracy.
I feel like it's the one that gets less coverage, yeah.
Remember once, Todd, I said on an earlier episode, I think maybe this didn't make the final cut, but it was like, oh, you know, you can just get truckloads of 10,000 people to vote fraudulently and swing an election, right?
I believe your claim was that you had a plan for how to generate 10,000 votes. Which I was really interested at the time of hearing, but we had to move on. So if you're going to present that now, I would love to hear it.
I have it, and here it is. And viewers, please implement these ideas if you're interested, but don't break any laws. As I did my digging into this, I found some people believe that Democrats are going to load people onto buses in Chicago on voting day. After they vote in Chicago, they're going to bring them to Wisconsin to vote, where legal residents are allowed to register on election day.
Mm-hmm.
So you could easily cart 10,000 people over. I don't know how you make them legal residents of Wisconsin, but I'm sure there's a way. How are you going to prevent that?
What is the capacity of a typical bus?
Oh, you know, 80.
80 people. So for 10,000 votes, we're talking in excess of 100 buses?
You know, there are so many buses. And, you know, you could do multiple rounds in the day. Wisconsin's only a couple hours away. Yeah, so maybe 50 buses.
Mm-hmm. This is a conspiracy that depends on well over 10,000 people keeping their mouths shut about what they did on that day.
Oh, yeah.
there's nothing logistically wrong with the thing that you're describing. I would just point out that the optics of such an action would be quickly detected.
So I will get to your point in just a second. I actually agree with you. But other creative ways that people thought there would be fraud are, for instance, politicians would go to Chicago and pay homeless people to vote a specific way, which you could guess, which they think happens way too much. And that does happen in some countries. And I wouldn't be surprised if to some extent that could happen. Electronic stuff. People don't really fully understand what's behind the scenes in any electronic voting. So you can imagine there'd be suspicion that it's corruptible and abusable to erase votes in some way. Absentee ballots. There's accusations that absentee ballots could get intercepted or destroyed. And then lastly, it's easier to keep control over things in a small town. People know each other, as fewer numbers of people to come in and out. And it's just a lot easier to keep an eye on what's happening versus when you get into larger cities.
Mm-hmm.
So across the board, these are the types of things that I've seen when people think that voter rigging can occur. But as you mentioned, there's actually quite a robust system in place and checks at every levels and watchers that are not representative of either party, as well as representatives from both party in a fairly balanced way at these polls, and locked boxes that can't be opened the entire day. Like huge sets of processes that it seems that if these things happen at a wide scale, somebody would notice and it would get reported. And when there is anything weird and it does get reported, and they do investigations, like you said.
Yeah.
So, well, I did used to believe that it could happen wide scale. Like, it's harder these days. You have to be really smart.
Yeah. I think you'd make a good point that the possibility for these things to happen at lower levels when the scope of the election is smaller is more probable. I still wouldn't call it probable, but at least it would be conceivably easier to pull off than something that would actually affect the national, like a national election.
The second of the three ways that we think about rigged elections. Second one is media bias, and then third will be systemic. But media bias, I really want to know what you think about this.
I'm going to start off with my somewhat flippant response is that unfortunately, sometimes the facts have a liberal bias.
The facts have a liberal bias.
We can discuss the validity of it. I mean, let me just say that that's the perspective that I think is shared among many populations within the liberal or progressive community.
I understand that, but you have to realize that the reason Republicans reject some of those data points is because take a population that relies on data to form their opinions. Mm-hmm. Now take people creating data that cherry picks the types of statistics that they think will show and prove their point, finds those things proving their point, and shows them to the people who blindly accept data for their decisions. They're very susceptible to manipulation by who's asking what questions and how deep are they going in unearthing causalities. So you can have data about the GDP that appears to have GDP was benefited by these social programs because of the timeline, and that's shown to liberals. And they're like, ah, our social programs worked. But they're not showing other factors that also counted into that GDP growth, or they're not showing the trade policy change, or they're not showing that we had come off of a huge recession and that it would normally have bounced back anyway. So yes, liberals rely on data and maybe are more likely to look for data to back up their points. But the point the Republicans make is, well, what is that data? You're not scrutinizing it enough and you're not digging deep enough. You're using confirmation bias when you find data that aligns with what you think. And I think it's a very valid point.
I'm not going to disagree that the problem is semi-symmetric and that both liberal and conservative media will cherry pick or choose to highlight certain things and not highlight other things in such a way as to make their particular candidate or position look favorable. I think the issue comes up is when we try to draw a false equivalence between the extent to which this happens on both sides. And it's very difficult to break the symmetry of this, of both sides saying, well, it's not a false equivalence. Look at what this side does and look at what that side does. And I don't know how to break the symmetry there.
I like how you describe that. Like each side will name call the other and say that the other side is worse at the name calling. I mean, I've been intimately close to people on both sides, so I've heard basically the same arguments being thrown at the other. So how does one tell if they're not firmly in one camp or the other? Like, side A accuses side B of being malicious and mean in name calling, because side B really is. Side B sees that and is like, no, no, side A is really malicious and name-calling and finds their own examples. Well, is it actually equal, or is it side B just reacting because they want it to be true on both sides so that they're not wrong?
Right.
But you end up hearing the same thing from both sides. It's hard to assess.
It's just that bigger issue of the fact that we can't even agree on what we agree on anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sort of where the claims of media bias sort of ring most true, is that like we don't even start from the same set of facts mm-hmm. that we all agree on. We don't even agree on the interpretation of the data points. And so coming to any kind of consensus on policy, it's basically impossible because both sides are going in such diametrically opposed directions.
The key elements of persuasion or negotiation are to start at the most base level of what are the things you agree on. You might already agree on all the facts and some of the conclusions out of the facts, but just have a different set of values of how those then impact you. And then it's just a discussion of how do you negotiate those values. But if you don't agree on the conclusions or the future implications, or even lower down on the facts, you have to identify first what are the facts that you disagree with. And then when you can identify what those are, then you can solve the problem. Politics just keeps it at this high level values thing, and it never lets us talk about what specific data do we agree or disagree on.
I think that's an incredibly astute observation, and I can't think of a worse system for dealing with it than the 24/7 news cycle. So that is a big problem. And then the last thing that can factor into an election being rigged is a structural issue. And the primary example I want to discuss about that is our two-party system.
God, I hate that thing.
Yeah, isn't it the worst?
It's just awful. It's the opposite of the best.
When you have a two-party system, if you don't agree with either of the choices, you really have no other choice. And it's sadly a consequence of the voting system we have in this country, where whoever gets the most votes is the winner. And that's a system of voting known as first past the post or plurality elections.
If candidate one gets 30%, candidate two gets 29%, candidate three gets 28%, something like that. The 30% guy just wins. There's no runoff, nothing.
Yep. This contrasts with something like the election system where the number of seats allocated to each party is proportionally related to the number of votes that that party got. And so you have a multi-party system in that country.
Right.
It's interesting because there is a principle called Duverger's Law, which predicts that this is the outcome that you get, that the voting system that you have directly impacts the number of parties that will be viable in that system. In a first-past-the-post system or in a plurality system like we have in the United States, a two-party system is almost guaranteed because over time, the weaker parties will fall apart or form into coalitions, larger coalitions, in order to have any chance of having their views heard in the government. So it leads to this fusion of into two main parties. Not always the same two main parties, but usually a very stable arrangement.
And why would you call a two-party system therefore rigged?
Let's say that there is a policy or a opinion shared by a majority of the people that is contrary to both parties. For example, if you wanted to impose term limits on electoral officials, or if you wanted to reduce the influence of lobbyists or the ability of people to give large amounts of money to a campaign, well, neither of the two major parties wants those things to happen because they're benefiting tremendously from the system as it is right now. And so it's impossible, or at least very difficult, to implement changes that are desired by a majority of the populace, but not by either of the two major parties. Let me provide an example. So Ross Perot's candidacy in the 1992 presidential election, he got 19% of the popular vote, and you can guess how many electoral votes he got.
Two?
Zero. So even in a situation where you have a reasonable chunk of the population that says, hey, we want some of these things that the other two parties don't want, the viability of a candidate even running with 20% of popular opinion is zero. That person has no chance. Whether we used the Electoral College or whether we used direct popular vote percentage, Bill Clinton would have still won that election.
How do we know for sure that the American people's desires aren't correctly represented right now by Trump and Hillary? Everyone complains about it, but people complain about everything. There were so many candidates out there, and most of us were disappointed by most of them on the Republican side. The establishment candidate didn't come through on the Republican side. So here's a great example how the few set of people with a lot of power didn't get their way. Why do we feel that we don't have control?
I think there was a very good study that was done by, I believe it was Princeton. Let's say that you have an issue and you poll the population on the issue. And let's say that, you know, 60% of people are in favor of a specific policy. In a perfect system, you would sort of imagine that there'd be, I guess, a 60% chance that the government implements that policy, or at least that the chance that the government implements that policy is proportional to the amount of public support that it gets. Would you expect that in a fair system, that the policies of that the government are at least proportional to what the population wants?
I wouldn't. In part, now we get into the idea that people who are not necessarily educated in how policy actually needs to work or how budgets work or specific defense issues will incorrectly propose things that they think are good for them but actually aren't.
So this is a point of disagreement where I think you are more in favor of overruling the will of people when you perceive them to not be, I'll say, educated on an issue, whereas I tend to come down more on, I don't really care what their level of education on an issue is. I care more about reflecting the opinions of the population. But that's a separate discussion.
The reason we elect representatives is because it's their job to know how to rule and how to run a country and how to organize things. As a manager, I can tell you that the people that, you know, when I wasn't a manager and people who are individual contributors don't really know all the things that go on behind the scene to make things work. So while they propose things and they say they want, let's just say, working from home every day, maybe 100% of employees want to be able to work from home every day. In practicality, the management knows that it's impossible to run a business that way. They'll lose clients to competitors. Communication will get poorer. You know, there's a lot of reasons that people can't just get everything that they want, even if they all want that. So I feel it's completely ridiculous. You can't just say if 100% of people want something, then that should be legislated. No, there needs to be expertise filtering what they want to what will be an overall good balance while taking into account both what they want and what's needed.
We can disagree about how much it should be reflected, but there should be at least some correlation between the amount of support that public opinion has for a policy and the likelihood that the government will implement that policy.
Oh, some correlation. Of course. Some. You didn't say some before.
Oh, sorry. I meant to say. Yeah, my point is that in a governmental system, you would expect to see some correlation between the amount of popular opinion for a policy and the likelihood that Congress takes up that policy.
You'd think so. And right now, you're not getting all that. So you're thinking the system is rigged against people getting...
Yep. The Princeton study showed that there was precisely zero correlation between the amount of public opinion for a policy and the likelihood that that policy would be implemented.
Wait, really?
Zero correlation. Let me caveat that. Zero correlation for the bottom 90% of income earners. For the top 10% of income earners, it was quite well correlated.
It's hard to say when you cross the line of fair enough, but I think we would agree it's not fair enough now. 10% of people's voices being accounted and 90% not.
That strikes me as the very definition of unfair.
That seems unfair, yes. We're going to a system, but really just if we're just talking about the election of the president, saying that's rigged or not, just focusing on that one question and forgetting about voting or media bias, still don't know how you could say one way or another. Like, you know, it takes a substantial career and a lot of relationships with people in power to do big things, and it takes big things generally to get noticed enough and have enough support to be able to go and campaign. Not sure how to fix that.
So if we're moving to solutions, I think the first step in this whole process is to introduce alternative voting systems that make it easier for third-party candidates to get representation. And I think I've spoken multiple times about the Maine ballot referendum to implement ranked choice voting in their state, which the last time I checked was on course to pass. So I'm enthusiastic about that.
No, I think it's a great idea. We had that in our university and it seemed to work pretty well. I mean, another option would be having the runoff option. If the first place person doesn't have a majority, or if they're within certain percentage points of the second place person, then you do a runoff. Mm-hmm. Although Argentina has a system, and it's, I think, the first time that they actually had the third party candidate come out of nowhere and then make it into the top two and then have the runoff and have that candidate win. So it still wouldn't guarantee as quick a turnover, since this is, I think, the first time they actually needed to use the runoff. So I would say that's not the optimal solution.
I have no issue. I would support a runoff system. I think it's simpler and cheaper to have an instant runoff or a, you know, ranked choice voting system. So you can just do all of those runoffs basically in the first ballot. That's what I would say is, like, within every person's state, like, look to see if there is a campaign for modifying the voting system in your state. And if there isn't, you can start one.
Let's do that via a direct democracy proposition.
Right. We're both big fans of self-improvement. I think we've talked about it on the show. We're always looking for ways to make better decisions or implement better habits. Or
I'm actually a bigger fan of self-disimprovement. We can talk about self-improvement too.
It seems like very little effort needs to be expended for self-disimprovement. That's something that just comes through normal entropic processes.
Very good at that. I'm the best at self-disimprovement.
Yeah, so this is something that was been on my mind because a year ago, I made a decision to take some steps for self-improvement in my life. And looking back now, the biggest change that I made that I think has had the most bang for the buck was to start documenting the process that I was using through journaling and through taking logs of various metrics in my life, my health, my sleep, things like that. And mm-hmm. the reason that I think this is important is because our brains are terrible at remembering the things that we've done. They're very fuzzy and provide their own narrative. And so it's difficult to get at the true facts, as it were, of how things went in the past. And by having an objective documentation of how things were going in the past, you have a way of reflecting on how effective your self-improvement steps have been. And I wanted to share that it's been valuable for me to have a record of those things. And I'm sort of encouraging that among people. Do you know Tim Ferriss?
Oh, yes. The 4-minute work week, those things.
Yeah, he's the author of the 4-hour work week.
Oh, there you go. 4-hour, not 4-minute. I almost went to a birthday party where he showed up. I didn't know he'd be there in Colombia.
Oh, boo. I know. He has a podcast called The Tim Ferriss Show, and he interviews, you know, movers and shakers in all industries and areas and tries to get at what processes and skills that they use in their daily lives. And like 90% of them use some sort of journaling technique in order to help keep track of the things that they do in their life. And sometimes they're really short. Like I think he has something called a bullet journal or a 5-minute journal, which is really just a few minutes at the beginning and end of every day. I guess what I'm saying is journaling doesn't have to be onerous. And it's a process that is used almost universally by highly successful people around the world. And so I've adopted it and found it helpful. Do you do anything like this? Do you keep a record or how do you sort of check yourself to see if the things that you're trying to improve in your life are getting better?
Trying to improve in my life, huh?
Yeah.
1 year ago, I made the decision to stop trying to improve myself.
Interesting.
And then a week later, I moved to Argentina.
Can I get back to what you mean when you say that you consciously tried to stop improving yourself? That's a curious statement to me.
I'm going to answer your question indirectly. What I used to do to keep track of my own improvement is I would just have metrics in my head all the time. Probably not the most effective way, but I would kind of note each year. I'd kind of have a theme of the year. And I wish I had written them down so I'd not remember them. But it would be, oh, this is the year I get into volleyball, or oh, this is the year I focus on work improvement on the following two things, or, oh, this is the year I work on being more social so I could be less shy because I used to be shy. Mm-hmm. But I drove myself mad with so much self-improvement over the years, as many women will do. Actually, I think pretty correlated. So a year ago, when I was kind of tired of improving myself and improving my career and improving my professional hireability and those things, I decided that my only goal for this time off that I was taking was to not have a goal and not try to self-improve, but to listen to myself each day, notice things that I liked, that I disliked, notice how I'm feeling, and just observe without any judgment of things about myself. Because normally I would just react to a situation and try to fix it, but not have observed and absorbed that thing that triggered that to begin with. So I guess in a sense, my self-improvement was to stop trying to maniacally self-improve. But I didn't really write it down.
I think like that sort of attitude shift that you're talking about is a perfectly valid thing to want to pursue. I'm curious, do you feel like it would have been helpful? Like you mentioned that you wish you'd written down, you know, some of the goals that you had for a year. Do you feel like it would be valuable now to look back over this last year and see sort of how your efforts went on adopting this new attitude?
I do. in a way sporadically every couple of weeks. I would write down a diary entry, or maybe 3 or 4 days in a row, I would write down how I'm feeling and how things are without structure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recommend it. I think structure is great and it would be a lot easier to track such things over time. But at one point I actually did try some of these apps where you're recording how you're feeling and what you did each day. And later you can start to correlate. And over a 2 week period, I did it every day. And then I saw 10 metrics and I saw, oh, when I sleep better or when I'm comfortable at home, I have a better attitude, but sometimes I don't. So for me, it was actually hard to pick the patterns out of the data. So I stepped back and didn't record stuff and kind of looked back and said, okay, one day I'd maybe think about, oh, well, 6 months ago, I remember I was thinking X, Y, Z, and now I'm thinking this other way. So even though today I didn't do much or I had a stressful day, I can still see a change.
Sure.
I really want to hear more about what you think and what you do and how it helps you.
Oh, for sure. I think that kind of self-reflection is really important. And I think for me personally, I found it incredibly valuable to be able to look back at a documented view of how I was thinking so I can remember what my motivations were for taking certain mm-hmm. actions.
Yeah.
Because I guess personally, my memory is my memory is appallingly bad. Maybe this is just a personal problem, but I know for a fact that I can't trust the way that I remember events, especially ones that happened, you know, far in the past. And so
it's because you're so old.
I know. I'm not even that old.
And you're just getting ancient. Oh, I'm the same as you.
Yeah. So think about how bad it's going to be as I get even older. So for me, it's almost a necessity for me to document these things so I have any sense of what it was like to be past me. Like, I know a big thing for me was I made a conscious decision to sort of greatly reduce the amount of gaming I was doing in my life. Not that it was a problem for what was going on, but I just found that there was a lot. I always felt that there were these things that I wanted to do, like learning a language or doing music or starting this, like a project like this podcast, that I always felt like I wish I would do, but I felt like I didn't have the time to do it. And I just made this conscious decision to run an experiment and just sort of cut all of that out of my life. Like cut gaming down to basically nothing and just see what happens, right? Like I think we've talked about making small bets before, these like little experiments that you can run over a short period of time and just to see how they affect your life. If it's an improvement, great. And if it's not, whatever, you've only wasted, you know, a short period of time. And it has been really useful for me, very illuminating to go back and look at how I felt during that time, the kinds of things that motivated me to make that decision, and sort of the results of that decision. Like I look now, we've got this podcast, which is a lot of fun. You know, I've got other activities that I'm doing in the community. And I find I don't really miss the time that I was spending on gaming. Not that gaming isn't a great hobby and, you know, I've had a lot of fun doing it, but like I made that decision a while back and it's been interesting to see sort of the results. Like it gives me a way to check against, is the life that I'm living now better than the one I was living before? And I think having that journal tells me that it is. Mm-hmm.
Is it structured? Do you have like entries you make each day or do you just write about how you feel?
Oh my goodness, let's decide how deep we want to get into my process.
I think you promised a few weeks ago that you would post an example of your journal or your metrics tracker.
I did include in, oh my gosh, it's many, many episodes ago, episode 3, 4, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I'll put it in the show notes, but I did include a picture of my health metrics tracker, which is useful in and of itself, but the journal I find is much better for more qualitative assessments of my quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
I have journaling as part of my weekly review process. So
wait, you have a weekly review process? What's that about?
I have a weekly, a monthly, and a quarterly review process, yes.
Holy crap.
Why is this strange?
You're not at work and you don't get this quarterly, you don't get these reviews built into your work, so you have to do it for your personal home life.
That's actually fairly accurate. This is something that I've noticed, and it's been interesting to me that in school, we don't really, like self-improvement is not taught in any kind of systematic way. We have to hope that your parents teach you some kind of good habits or that you pick them up sort of as you go on through life. But this has been something that I've found has taken a lot of conscious effort on my part to have a rigorous system of self-improvement. Like it doesn't happen if you don't consciously take steps toward it. And so having this review process is sort of my way of reflecting on the activities that I'm undertaking and to provide a chance to plan for the activities that I want to do in the future.
Oh, I just had one comment about the idea of writing down your thoughts at the end of the day and what that one reason that I hesitate and maybe some other people do.
Mm-hmm.
Is to me, it's a physics analogy. Haha. To me, there's so many things running around my brain that I kind of want to remember them all and I want to think about them and ruminate and keep them and make new connections. Like, oh, I think about the party I went to, and then I can remember two conversations one night from that party. And then the next morning I wake up and I'm still thinking about the party, and I remember another person I met, and I think, oh, maybe I should introduce them to my brother because my brother is interested in the same topic. And then I write some emails, and, you know, having these experiences and conversations in my head all the time, I feel I can relive them. Maybe it's like living in the past, I don't know, but there is fresh content to keep taking from for about 3 days, which I found is approximately how long my memories tend to last, freshly.
Mm-hmm.
So I liken this to, in physics, you have this dual wave particle theory, light traveling through space is a waveform, at the same time it's a particle. Mm-hmm. So let's say you have a wave shining through a bunch of slits, and in reality, in the wave state, it kind of went through all at the same time, and then it creates an additive pattern on the other side, and you have dispersion and stuff. But if you actually measure the light with detectors on the other side, an actual photon only physically supposedly went through one of the slits.
Right. And it destroys that very nice pattern of waves on the other side.
You had a million places the particle was sort of going, but once you wrote down or measured one of them, it only went through that one. So my concern with journaling is that when I sit down and write, because my writing goes a lot slower than my thinking, I'm only going to then remember the things that I bothered in that one sitting to write down, and my memory becomes solidified in that subversion of it.
Journaling captures your memory like measuring a photon collapses a waveform. That may be the nerdiest description of a journal I've ever heard. But I understand what you're saying. I guess I totally get what you're saying. I guess I would say I would rather have at least a decomposed waveform of what I was thinking, like at least a sliver of what I was thinking, than nothing at all.
That's a good point, especially when we're 80.
Oh gosh, yes. No, I get what you're saying. It's hard to decide, and like I have to, you know, time cop myself, or basically just say I'm going to write for this long, or I'm going to write this number of sentences. I don't know. I guess my point in all this today is to say that I think if anyone out there is thinking about, you know, embarking upon self-improvement goals, or have sort of struggled with ones in the past, I think setting up a system of reflection is a huge deal.
Do you recommend writing by hand versus typing?
I type, but I think it should be whatever has the least barrier to you, like whatever is the easiest. Personal preference.
Yeah, write by hand is slower, but also forces you to pick more carefully the words you say.
Do whichever one you're most likely to do.
Collapse the photon in a more effective way. Yeah.
Exactly.
So Todd, I have a brilliant idea.
I'm listening. I love brilliant ideas.
I'm glad you always listen to me then. This is only going to help me and going to be work for you, but that's why you should do it.
I'm listening.
I want you to be my accountability partner, and I want to start setting up some of these types of things in my life.
Okay.
That'd be great. And maybe we can even come back and revisit this in a few weeks on another episode and say, how's it doing? How's Dinah's accountability stuff going?
This sounds like a phenomenal idea, and I love every part of it. There's nothing like public accountability to hold you to your goals.
Oh, jeez. Did we say public?
That's the whole point, right? We're going to present how Dinah is doing on her.
God. No, yeah, that's, I can do that.
Okay, what are we doing? We got this Trump date thing.
Trump, oh my God. I've started finally watching the Saturday Night Live versions of the debates, and they're hilarious. Have you seen them?
I enjoy them very much.
Oh, Alec Baldwin, oh my God. Best Trump.
Maybe a year ago when Donald Trump was on Saturday Night Live, he was tweeting nonstop about how great it was. And then a mere year later, he's recently tweeted about how much he hates it and how it's garbage and should be canceled. So, how quickly the tide has turned.
Can you find those tweets and post them too?
I will find the tweet separated by less than a year of him going on Saturday Night Live and saying it's great, and now him recently saying it's garbage. So yeah, the note I have here for the Trump date today is it's all over but the crying.
It's all over but the crying.
I have not removed the rock from my button in some time.
From your vote today button.
Yeah, we definitely want to hold the vote today and every day between now and November 8th.
Like, okay, you know, you see these graphs of the poll data over time, and I'll probably have to post one, but just pretend that you see my fingers, my index and forefinger together, a little bit separate. And then they widen, widen, widen as I move my arm to the right. And then they come together again, almost touching. And then they widen, but not as far as the first time. And they come together, you know, like this cyclical thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the whole thing is kind of sloping upward a little bit, only the top one is sloping upward slightly less. So if you went to infinity, they would meet.
Mm-hmm.
The top one is Hillary's polling ratings, and the bottom one is Trump's polling ratings. So it's like two sort of sine waves where they keep coming together and going farther apart. This is what the polls have been looking like if you look online for the last 6-9 months. It's pretty fascinating. And they're fairly cyclical. So, it seems like predictable periods. The thing is, right now, they're kind of far apart. So Trump just needs an extra month and a half. And if we had that much more time, it might actually catch back up to again. And he, that one time when he actually was above the ratings is when they come together and it actually crossed over. The two sine waves crossed over and he was just a little bit above Hillary.
Yeah.
So, I think that the disadvantage is just the timing where we are in the sine waves.
I guess the challenge he's also facing is that as we get closer to the election, the number of people saying that they're going to vote for either Gary Johnson or Jill Stein becomes smaller and smaller, and it doesn't appear like those third-party candidates are breaking in a favorable way for Donald Trump.
You have to show me that data, quote-unquote truth, or whatever you call it.
My liberal facts.
Let me show me your liberal facts, and I'll see how I interpret them with my opinions.
I was going to say, the other thing that's interesting is we may, for the first time in who knows how long, actually have a third-party candidate win electoral votes. And do you know where that is?
Ooh. Maine?
It is in Utah.
Oh, you kidding?
No.
Thank you, Mitt Romney, for leading your Mormon contingent against Trump in Utah, which would normally go to the Republicans, I would assume.
So, yes, there's a candidate in Utah by the name of Evan McMullen who is polling very close to both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in the state of Utah, and there is a quite reasonable chance that he picks up Utah's electoral votes. And so that would be the first time in many, many, many years that a third-party candidate has won electoral votes. So that will be interesting if it happens. It also creates a slightly greater, but still, to my mind, insignificant chance that the entire election would get thrown to the House of Representatives, because if neither Trump nor Clinton get the 270 electoral votes required to win the election because of McMullen winning Utah, then we have to go to the House of Representatives to decide who our president is.
How many votes does Utah get in the Electoral College?
Utah has 6 electoral votes.
Yeah, okay, interesting, interesting. If it's that close, then if Utah had gone to Hillary, Trump would have won. Then we can say Mitt Romney effectively did prevent Trump from becoming the next president by making his state's electoral votes go to the other guy and taking away the last few that Trump needed, maybe. Do you know who I would vote for? First of all, I'm not going to vote, I think, because to do so requires me getting Cambridge, Massachusetts to send a ballot to me somewhere overseas, and I don't know where I'll be. I don't have an address out here, so I don't really have a way to receive the ballot and then send it back to vote.
Mm-hmm.
See, but if I were to vote...
Are you going to write in your boy, Romney?
I'll keep you in suspense.
You'll keep me in suspense? You're going to wait until... Well played. Well played, my friend.
Okay, my answer is I want a balanced Supreme Court. I think corporate taxes should be way lower so that businesses actually start coming back into the U.S. for their headquarters. It's 11% of the federal budget. That could go up significantly. It'd be helpful. And I do not think that free open borders is the way to go, which is what Hillary kind of pushes, even though she was against this latest trade deal. So those are some of my most important issues.
I'm fully in favor of us adopting a voting system that would enable you to vote for a candidate who shares those principles while also not being...
Either
of the existing choices.
The answer is I'm glad I don't have to vote.
Yeah, I can understand that.
I would hate the outcome either way. If I voted for Clinton, I couldn't then criticize the next 4 years of policies I disagree with. If I voted for Trump, I couldn't live with myself.
So I guess we'll know the results of the elections here in just a few short weeks. It'll be really exciting.
Do you have your Canadian citizenship lined up yet?
Gosh, no. But we have some friends who are visiting from England, and they're staying with us. And we've made it conditional for them staying with us that they take us back to England in their suitcases if Trump wins the election. So that would have the dual purpose of both getting us out of the country and satisfying my losing of the bet and having to visit you in an international location. So it's a twofer.
Oh. Yeah, good point. Oh, that's not fair.
So hopefully that doesn't happen, but we'll find out soon. Till then, thanks for listening to this episode of the Maximize This podcast. As always, you can discuss this episode on our Facebook page and also on our Reddit. We'd love to hear your perspective and ideas for future topics.
And our website, as always, is www.maximizethis.fm. Check it out for news, new episodes, bonus features, and tell your friends how much you love the show.
And be sure to leave a rating and a review on iTunes. It really gets our name out there and does a lot to help support the show. So we'd really appreciate that.
And it's really easy to do. I've done it. I gave us 5 stars.
I only gave us 4.
That's a lie, because I checked and they all gave us 5. Until next time, don't let pretty good be the enemy of perfect. So I have like 5 more factoids. You have to stop asking all these interesting questions.
If there's time at the end, you can continue telling more.